Rolling Stone, Rolling Stone. Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother? Yeah. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? This is Dan Klingel, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today will be our final session reading from the Rolling Stone Special Collector's Edition on Prince, The Ultimate Guide to His Music and Legend. This article is entitled A Final Visit. In 2014, Prince opened up Paisley Park for an intimate hang. No one knew it would be his last Rolling Stone interview. This by Brian Hyatt, and I should mention that there is some strong profanity in this article. This is excerpted from Rolling Stone magazine of May 19, 2016. It is, in theory, a mundane night, nothing to get excited about, just a 55-year-old man in his suburban Minneapolis workplace, scrolling through a Windows Media Player library on a clunky Dell computer. An equally ordinary multi-line phone sits beside it, near a lit candle, bottled water, and some expensive-looking lotion. A huge old Xerox machine looms over the desk. A window at the far end of the room looks out onto barren trees and an empty snow-lined highway. It's early evening on Saturday, January 25th, 2014, in Chanhassen, Minnesota. The office is on the second floor of the 65,000-square-foot Paisley Park compound. The little guy sitting at the keyboard owns it all. Had it all built back in the 80s. And Prince being Prince, it's fascinating to watch him do just about anything. The more ordinary the activity, clicking a mouse, say, the weirder it feels. Prince has a large afro and he's dressed in dark, diaphanous layers, with a vest over a flowing, long-sleeved shirt, form-fitting, grayish-black slacks, and sneakers with high, lucite heels that light up with every step. He's wearing obvious makeup, foundation, eyeliner, probably more. His thin, precision-trimmed mustache extends just past his lips in a semicircle. On characteristically short notice, Prince invited me here to report what we intend to be his 7th Rolling Stone cover story. I spend 7 hours at Paisley Park, and he sits for 2 lengthy, thoughtful, amiable interviews. I was told not to curse or to ask about the past, though I eventually violated both rules. He invites me to join him on the road later. In the end, however, he won't sit for a photo shoot, instead offering us pre-prepared, heavily retouched pictures. The whole thing falls through. I hold on to my reporting, assuming, all too correctly, that we will save the material for our next Prince cover. That night, Prince doesn't look his age. Doesn't look any particular age, really. He's very thin, but not fragile. A strict vegan who, by his own account, sometimes doesn't eat at all. I've gone long periods with no food, and also water. People have to remind me to drink water, because I always forget to do that. He doesn't sleep enough, either, and he avoids sex. One of the most deliriously sensual performers who ever lived insists he's celibate. His reasons are both religious and energy-related. The hunger turns into something else, he says. Though he maintains close relationships with several young female singer-songwriters, he is, at this stage in his life, a kind of cheerful musical monk. I am music, he says. Playing it is his greatest and perhaps only pleasure. But he's been an ascetic even on that front as of late, recording less than ever, waiting 4 years between albums. It'll stand as the longest break of his career. Prince famously liberated himself from his record deal with Warner Brothers in 1996, and it apparently took him years to realize that his freedom extended to not releasing music. I write more than I record now, and I also play live a lot more than I record, he says. I used to record something every day. I always tease that I have to go to studio rehab. I'm a very in-the-moment person, he continues. I do what feels good in the moment.
I'm not on a schedule, and I don't have any sort of contractual ties. I don't know in history if there's been any musicians that have been self-sufficient like that, not beholden. I have giant bills, large payrolls, so I have to do tours. But there's no need to record anymore. He makes a direct connection between fasting, celibacy, and his abstention from recording. After 4 days, you don't want food anymore. It's like this thing that says, "Feed me, feed me." When it realizes it's not going to get fed, it goes away. It's the same with music. I had to see what it's like to stop making albums. And then you go, "Oh, wait a minute. I don't feel the need to do that anymore." Prince brings me up to the office to play tracks from Plectrum Electrum, the album that would finally break his recording fast. He chose from 100 or so songs laid down in one of the downstairs studios with his recently formed backing band, Third Eye Girl, the hardest rocking ensemble he has ever assembled. "All recorded live, no punch-ins," he says. "You just do it till you get the take you like." The album doesn't come out for 8 months, by which time it's accompanied by a more traditional Prince LP called Art Official Age. Prince and I meet for the first time a few minutes earlier, as he emerges from a rehearsal space with the young women of the band, Hannah Welton, the drummer, a bubbly 23-year-old who looks like Carrie Underwood and plays like John Bonham, introduces herself brightly. "Hi, I'm Hannah." Prince laughs, not unkindly, and imitates her chirping, "Hi, I'm Prince," in a high voice, as he reaches out a firm, businesslike handshake. His actual speaking voice is deep, soft, and calming, like a DJ on a smooth jazz station. As we walk along, he shows no sign of a reported double hip replacement surgery. No limp, no cane, no apparent discomfort. His brown eyes are alert, his wit is quick. Looking back, it's nearly impossible to square his affect with posthumous rumors of an opioid addiction. He claims not to feel the passage of time, and says mortality doesn't enter his thoughts. "I don't think about it. Gone." To the contrary, he is immersed in the moment, invested in a creative future that he believes will be long and bright. The pause between albums seems to have been healthy for him, as is the youthful, enthusiastic, near-worshipful presence of the Third Eye Girl members. For the first time in years, he's been opening up Paisley Park to local fans for spontaneous events. On his way upstairs, Prince struts past a hallway decorated with a photographic timeline of his career. There's Bat Dance, Prince, Slave on his face prints, and even his 1985 Rolling Stone cover. He notes that he refused to do a photo shoot, so we ran a still from a video that, in his considered opinion, made his teeth look strange. "There's room for Purple Rain or the Super Bowl here," he notes of one empty space, murmuring something about eventually turning Paisley Park into a museum. It already seems a bit like one, a huge, dark, nearly empty space with only a skeleton crew on hand. We stop at a mural where a painted image of Prince, arms spread, stands astride images of his influences and artists he, in turn, influenced. He tests me, making sure I can recognize Chaka Khan and Sly and the Family Stone, while giving me a pass on missing Tower of Power and Grand Funk Railroad. Playing the album in his office, he charmingly takes pains to turn the player's visualizer function on, providing State of 2002 fractal accompaniment to the music. On a stand in the corner is a century-old Portuguese guitar with a teardrop-shaped body. A Canon telephoto lens with no camera attached sits atop a couple of coffee table books, Vanity Fair's Hollywood, Palaces of Naples. The walls of the office are painted in a blue skies motif with the words Dream Style on one of them. Hanging on another wall is a clock emblazoned with the cover of his 2007 album, Planet Earth, the only timepiece of any kind I see anywhere in Paisley Park. He puts on one of the album's poppier tracks, the sweet throwback, Stop This Train, with vocals from Third Eye Girl drummer Welton and her husband, Josh. I suggest, gently, that the song might fare best on the charts if no one knows of its Prince connection. He nods. That's kind of the blessing and a curse these days, he says, that I'm competing with my older music. They always play Beyoncé's latest track, but I go on Oprah, and they want me to play what they remember. He ends by previewing a couple of songs from what will become Art Official Age, excusing himself from the room when he gets to the wailing ballad, Breakdown. The breakup theme lyrics seem particularly personal. I used to throw the party every New Year's Eve, first one intoxicated, last one to leave, waking up in places that you would never believe. Give me back the time, you can keep the memories. Afterward, he confirms that the song comes from a sensitive, nude place. You could touch it, and it would just hurt instantly. Before Prince sits for an interview, there is another test. I sit and chat with the members of Third Eye Girl in a cavernous atrium, where the black carpet is decorated with Prince's old symbol and the words NPG Music Club, and the motorcycle from Purple Rain is on display above. We gather on a purple couch that is noticeably frayed, and they explain their unlikely origins. The bassist, taciturn Denmark native Ida Nielsen, arrived first, joining Prince's bigger funk band, the latest incarnation of the new power generation, which he's still giggling with as well. Prince tells me how she beat out an old bandmate of his who re-auditioned. She was 8 times better than him, and she was new. Prince specifically wanted a female band, seeking out members via YouTube. Back in 2010, he had discovered Nielsen on MySpace. We're in the feminine aspect now, he says. That's where society is. You're going to get a woman president soon. Men have gone as far as they can, right? I learn from women a lot quicker than I do from men. At a certain point, you're supposed to know what it means to be a man. But now what do you know about what it means to be a woman? Do you know how to listen? Most men don't know how to listen. I ask Third Eye Girl's guitarist, Donna Grantis, who has a half-shaved head and Hendrixian chops, about her influences. Prince, she says flatly. Her husband, a pleasant rocker dude named Trevor Guy, came along with her and ended up working closely with Prince, serving some managerial functions. Prince believes artists shouldn't have managers. You should be a grown man and be able to man-age yourself. Josh, Welton's husband, an R&B singer-turned-producer, also became part of the Paisley family, working on some of Prince's final albums. They've all been living in a nearby hotel for a year and a half, spending at least 6 days a week in Paisley Park. They come off as members of a benign cult. It's an alternate universe being here, says Grantis, because we're in this awesome bubble of, like, making music all day. I have no idea what the date is or what day it is. As we talk, I glance over my shoulder and realize that Prince has at some point materialized behind me, silently eavesdropping. He nods and moves away again into the darkness. The band and I go into the industrial kitchen where we're served dinner, and I am soon summoned into the control room of the complex's Studio A, where Prince sits at a mixing desk. This room was built in 87, and the first record I did in here was Love Sexy, he says. We never really got this room clicking like any of my old home studios or the hot-rodded boards I used in Los Angeles when I had a record deal. It's real cozy and private. I just kind of wished it sounded like what goes on in my head. And I've been tinkering with things forever. I suppose I will keep messing with it, or another generation will. We talk of many things, and his ban on discussing the past turns out to be slightly flexible. He makes a point of noting that his reputation as the puppet master behind the Time and even Vanity 6 was exaggerated. It was all collaborative, he says. It's not just my vision. It's one thing to say, you know what would be cool, and visualize it, but then you've got to actually find the people. Time Machine's Morris Day is as good as any funk drummer who ever did it. In Vanity, nobody could talk like her. He's most passionate and lucid when he talks about music, Rock Steady by Aretha Franklin, Cold Sweat by James Brown, Aldous Stax Records, Ike and Tina Turner. We took it for granted, thinking that music would always be like that. That was just normal to us. There are frequent, sometimes tricky to follow, digressions. He seems to have branched out from his study of the Bible, which began in earnest when he became a Jehovah's Witness under the tutelage of bassist Larry Graham. "It's just all expanded," he says. "Anything I believed then, I believe even more now. It's just expanded." While still deeply Christian, he's also spent time studying what appears to be an Afrocentric interpretation of history, along with the physics of sound, some Eastern ideas, chakras are science, he says, and a selection of unabashed conspiracy theories on topics like the JFK assassination. "The car slows down. Why doesn't it speed up?" And the airplane trails, known in some circles as chemtrails. Think about where they appear, why they appear, how often, and what particular times of year. At one point, the phone rings. It's the young British singer-songwriter, Delilah. Prince's voice gets even deeper. "I know it's late here," he purrs into the handset. "I'm going to will you awake." On a possibly related note, Prince says he's unsure if he'll marry it again. "That's another thing that's up to God," he says. "It's all magnetism anyway. Something would pull me into its gravity, and I wouldn't be able to get out from it." We take a break and head to Paisley Park's empty nightclub, where Third Eye Girl are waiting on stage. "I can take you out there and hit this guitar for you," Prince promised earlier, "and what you'll hear is sex. You will hear something where you'd run out of adjectives, just like you do when you meet the finest woman." He wants to prove the Third Eye Girl can activate my chakras, so he seats me on a stool on stage, no more than 3 feet away from him. He picks up a custom Vox guitar, the brand some of James Brown's guitarists played. "You're going to start vibrating in a second," he tells me. He kicks the band into the fiery 70s fusion instrumental Stratus, tearing through solos that arc endlessly upward. He's warned of goosebumps and delivers. It's past midnight when we begin talking again. He mentions a desire to mentor Chris Brown, says he invited him to Paisley Park. I note that some people think what Brown did to Rihanna was unforgivable. He's shocked. "Unforgivable," he says. "Goodness, that's when we go check the master, Christ. Have you ever instantly forgiven somebody?" I shake my head. "It's the best feeling in the world, and it totally dismantles that person's whole stance." He talks more about mentoring and helping peers, so I wonder aloud if he thinks he could have forestalled Michael Jackson's fate. "I don't want to talk about it," Prince says at first. "I'm too close to it." He goes on. "He's just one of many who have gone through that door. Amy Winehouse and folks. We're all connected, right? We're all brothers and sisters, and the minute we lock that in, we wouldn't let anybody in our family fall. That's why I called Chris Brown. All of us need to be able to reach out and just fix stuff. There's nothing that's unforgivable." He seems to be hinting at past problems of his own, so I ask him if he was ever self-destructive. His eyebrows shoot up. "Self-destructive? I mean, do I look self-destructive?" This leads him to a disquisition on why he avoids talking about the past. "People say, why did you change your name and this and that and the other? I'm here right now, doing what I'm doing right now, and all of the things I did led up to this. And there's no place else I'd rather be than right now. I want to be talking to you, and I want you to get it." We talk about retirement. "I don't know what it is," he says. "There's always some way to serve. It feels like I'm teaching at a school, but also a student at one. I never felt like I had a job. Does that make sense?" So these words, job, retire. He tries to explain why he can imagine playing into old age with a dizzying detour into mysticism via the Wachowskis. "Lifespans are getting longer," he says. "One of the reasons is because people are learning more about everything. So then the brain makes more connections. Eventually, we'll be in eternal brain mode because we'll be able to hold eternity in our minds. A lot of people can't do that. If you can't think all the way back eternally, you can't think all the way forward eternally. Everybody usually thinks about a beginning, a big bang. If you take that event out, then you can start to see what eternity is. Remember in The Matrix where they said the only thing that has an ending had a beginning and vice versa? It's nearly 2 a.m., and Prince is done for the night. He walks me through the depths of Paisley Park, his shoes glowing in the dark, to retrieve my jacket and bag. As we walk, I hear doves cry, actual doves that live in a cage somewhere in the rafters. As I put on my coat, Prince invites me to join the band in London. The zipper catches badly on the way up. "Fuck," I say, and my host looks stricken. "So much for not cursing," he says. I apologize. Prince looks me in the eyes and wraps me in a tight hug. I am, as promised, dismantled by his instant forgiveness. I feel that embrace as I walk outside, where moonlight shines on a thick layer of immaculate, freshly fallen snow. Now we're on to a short article called The Paisley Shredder. Prince's guitar playing was explosive, funky, and thoroughly inventive, even if it was sometimes overlooked amid his other talents. This article is by Tom Morello, who's a very good rock guitarist in his own right. You may be familiar with him from bands like Rage Against the Machine. Underrated. That's the best word that describes Prince the guitarist. Why? Because his phenomenal guitar playing was just one arrow in a quiver full of remarkable talents. He was such a masterful singer, songwriter, producer, performer, bandleader, dancer, multi-instrumentalist, and global sex icon that his overall princeness often eclipsed what may have been his most formidable talent, playing guitar. There are many pop stars who are great performers, but there is no chart-topping pop star in history who could play guitar like Prince. Imagine if Michael Jackson had played the solo on Beat It. That was Prince on a Tuesday. His playing always sounded inspired, soulful, and fearless. He combined the showmanship of Jimi Hendrix with the incredible melodic sensibility of a seasoned jazz cat. He could play funky James Brown-style rhythms, like on Kiss, and he could play avant-metal solos, like the intro to When Doves Cry. It's an outrageous solo, certainly not the kind of sound that you'd expect to hear on a pop single, and he starts the song with it. I saw Purple Rain in the summer of '84, and Spinal Tap notwithstanding, it's the greatest rock and roll film of all time. There's so much Prince coming at you that you have to remind yourself he's also a breathtaking guitar player. When he plays the Purple Rain solo, it's life-changing. Put that on right now and try not to cry. And at the end of the movie, he conjures his genre-destroying guitar storm and does it in high heels on top of a piano while his guitar is squirting. You just can't compete with that. Purple Rain, the album, is a great guitar record. Let's Go Crazy has that driving rhythm riff that I loved playing at keg party cover band shows in college. And Darling Nikki is a fantastically slippery, sleazy guitar song, perfectly matching tone with intent. But let's not forget Prince's guitars themselves. From the male-female love symbol guitar to the curlicue one that kind of looks like an ocean wave, every guitar was a statement. How is it possible that guitars that look that crazy could also sound so good? It's not the guitar, of course, it's the player. Every guitar was an extension and an expression of the awesome Prince fire that was screaming out of the amps. Since his death, I've been watching videos of Prince's performances. Check out that great clip of him playing While My Guitar Gently Weeps at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 2004. He's on stage with Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, and Steve Winwood. Now those are people who are all-time rock icons. But then Prince steps forward like a badass gunslinger to play the solo. All eyes and ears turn as he effortlessly demonstrates a confident, cocky mastery of the instrument. His playing is deeply emotional, beautifully melodic, raw, inventive, and soul-stirring. And then when you least expect it, he just fucking flat out flies up and down the neck, shredding like Paganini and whirling like a dervish. The solo goes on for like 80 bars. It builds to a soaring, roaring crescendo of finesse and nuanced fury. And by the end of it, the other rock luminaries on stage have all faded into the background, left behind in a purple cloud. Spectacular. There was nobody like Prince. Now I'd like to read descriptions / reviews of a couple of Prince's most famous albums. Let's start with 1999, the pop breakthrough that owned MTV, won radio, and started a revolution. These are Rob Sheffield's comments about the album that was released in October of 1982. "Don't worry," announces the warped robot voice at the start of 1999. "I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun." Is this the voice of God, or Prince's synthesizers talking back to him? Either way, this guy's got his own idea of fun, and he spends the next 70 minutes building his spiritual and political philosophy around the urge to party. He sets off security sirens at the club by masturbating on the dance floor. He solves the nation's evils by staging a sex as redemption ritual with his lady cab driver in the back seat. He dances under the shadow of the mushroom cloud as the double drag warmongers finally hit the little red button and blow up the planet, but not before Prince squeezes in one more Saturday night of letting that lion in his pocket roar. He gathers musicians of different races and genders into a communal church dedicated to the higher purpose of getting Prince more action. You can't accuse the man of thinking small. At just 24, Prince dropped 1999 in October 1982. In career terms, it was supposed to be his art album. Maybe he'd crack rock radio, setting him up to make his pop crossover move next time. But the plan failed, because there was no way the pop audience could resist 1999. Prince ended up becoming a big-time star with his artiest, most extreme, and most demanding music. I think he was trying to become as mainstream as possible without violating his own philosophy, without having to compromise any of his ideas, keyboardist Matt Fink told Rolling Stone in 1989, when the magazine included 1999 on its list of the 100 best albums of the 80s. To some extent, he was trying to make the music sound nice, something that would be pleasing to the ear of the average person who listens to the radio, yet send a message. I mean, 1999 was pretty different for a message, not your average bubblegum hit. 1999 was an old-school double vinyl album, just two or three songs per side, giving the grooves room to flesh out his liberation theology. Nearly every song has Prince uttering a full-fledged manifesto or two, preaching the DMSR gospel: dance, music, sex, romance. The Led Zeppelin credo, "Do what thou wilt," became Prince's "Do whatever we want. Wear lingerie to a restaurant. Policeman got no gun. You don't have to run." And in case anyone accuses him of mere shock tactics, he explains his moral code in "Let's Pretend We're Married." "I'm not saying this just to be nasty. I sincerely want to fuck the taste out of your mouth. Can you relate?" Who couldn't? Prince recorded 1999 amid a creative frenzy that consumed him all through 1982, while he was simultaneously making albums for Vanity 6 and The Time. "I have the follow-up album to 1999, he told Rolling Stone in 1985, describing his furious pace of work. "I could put it all together and play it for you. You would go, yeah. I could put it out, and it would probably sell what 1999 did. But I always try to do something different and conquer new ground." Sessions were divided between Sunset Sound in Los Angeles, where he'd recorded Controversy, and the home studio in his purple house near Lake Minnetonka outside Minneapolis, which he'd recently outfitted with a 24-track recording system. "I think he found his groove," recalled drummer Bobby Z, "and the groove never left." Strange as it seems in retrospect, there was no reason to think his new music had any shot at pop radio. He was 3 years past his only top 40 hit, "I Want to Be Your Lover," but he clearly wasn't thinking in those terms. He made the music even more outrageous than the lyrics, experimenting with the newfangled technology of Oberheim synthesizers and Linn drum machines. He'd obviously studied the latest new wave records in the import bin. As guitarist Des Dickerson recently told Billboard's Michelangelo Matos, Prince was inspired by the new romantic thing, especially Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet, who were in rotation at First Avenue, the Minneapolis club immortalized in Purple Rain. 1999 came on as the ultimate new romantic statement. It was the synth-pop album to beat all other synth-pop albums. In the year, synth-pop took over. 1982 was full of futuristic electronic records mixing disco beats with arty concepts, from the Human League's Dare to Yazoo's Upstairs at Eric's, from George Clinton's Computer Games to Duran Duran's Rio. Hip-hop went techno with Afrika Bambaataa's Planet Rock and Looking for the Perfect Beat, and Grandmaster Flash's The Message. So did the goth punk kids in New Order with their club hit, Temptation. But as any of these artists probably would have conceded, Prince topped them all, creating his own kind of nonstop erotic cabaret. Instead of just overdubbing instruments to replicate a live band, he built the tracks around a colossal synth pulse, which made 1999 one of the decade's most influential productions. Little Red Corvette became such a massive pop hit, it's easy to overlook how radical it sounded at the time. All through the song, you can hear the machines puff and hiss, as if Prince's engines are overheating, and his studio is a Frankenstein lab full of sparks flying everywhere. It's sleek on the surface, but the rhythm track keeps sputtering and threatening to blow up. It's the sonic equivalent of George Lucas's breakthrough in the original Star Wars movie. He figured out that the way to make droids look real was to make them look dusty and dented, as if they'd gotten banged around on the job. MTV was clearly a huge influence on 1999, not just as a format for exposure, but as a source for the latest European synth sounds. Here was a network where David Bowie and Roxy Music were legacy artists, while Depeche Mode and Adam Ant were bona fide stars. This place was made for him. A flock of seagulls? Even their names sounded like a Prince lyric. Also significant about MTV in 1982 was that it was a nationwide rock and roll network with black artists in the mix, and one ripe for a black art rocker like Prince to take over, which he did. MTV played the 1999 video like it was manna from heaven. Radio still resisted. The 1999 single stalled short of the top 40. But MTV played the video so heavily that it was even used in the network's own stereo demonstration ads. When Little Red Corvette went into rotation, MTV kept right on playing 1999. Even though both videos looked suspiciously like they were filmed on the same day, with the same cast, wearing the same clothes. It didn't matter. The network couldn't get enough of the Minnesota Monarch, as MTV's J.J. Jackson called him. The nickname didn't catch on, though his royal badness did. By the time Michael Jackson came out with his much ballyhooed Billie Jean video, Prince was already MTV's signature artist. When Little Red Corvette finally invaded pop radio in the spring, it broke the whole album, pushing 1999 back onto the charts and up to number 12. Little Red Corvette was his love song to the girl with a pocketful of Trojans and probably a trunkful of unpaid parking tickets. She drives him to a sex lair decorated with pictures of her conquests, which some repress guys might have taken as a warning sign. But Prince figures it's Saturday night. Guess that makes it all right. He surrenders to her high horsepower libido. The title anthem didn't play coy about the Cold War dread that infused 1980s pop. With a trigger-happy Republican administration in the White House, it was shocking to hear Prince's synthesized kiddie voices gurgling the question, "Mommy, why does everybody have a bomb?" Delirious sounds like the safe novelty Prince put on the album in case radio chickened out of playing 1999, which it did at first, or Little Red Corvette, which took months to build into a blockbuster. But Delirious cracked the top 10 that fall, with a six-note synth whinny that could make you laugh loudly before you even noticed the words. Even the deep cuts are top-notch. All the Critics Love You in New York weighs in on that most bizarrely popular of 80s topics, bitching out music critics. Something in the Water Does Not Compute is a haunting computer blue ballad, with Prince moaning over dark wave synths, as if his frantic bedroom schedule can't fix the hole in his heart. Automatic and Lady Cab Driver are deeply melancholy sex jams, as in the moment when backup singers Lisa Coleman and Jill Jones announce, "I'm going to have to torture you now." Prince gives his bandmates vocal spotlights all over the album. He doesn't join the first verse of 1999 until Coleman, Jones, and Dickerson sing the opening lines. He credited his band on the cover. The words "and the revolution" were scrawled backward and included a sleeve photo of his racially and sexually integrated musicians. But as Dickerson said, it was always part of the rhetoric. He wanted a movement instead of just a band. He wanted to create that kind of mindset among the fans. With 1999, Prince started a movement the whole world wanted to join. The other album I wanted to feature is Purple Rain, which was released in June of 1984. The movie told the world his story. The soundtrack changed pop music forever, this by Alan Light. It didn't make any sense. He was a young artist with just a couple of pop hits and not much mainstream recognition beyond the kids who watched MTV, which was only 2 years old. But Prince had plans to star in a movie loosely based on his life. He'd been jotting down ideas for it in a purple notebook while on his bus tour, and he wanted his next album to be the soundtrack. And one other thing, he had a few songs, some of which had never been performed before, that he wanted to record on stage tonight. It was August 3rd, 1983, and Prince and the Revolution were back home in Minneapolis. On his previous tour to support 1999, he had been crisscrossing the country, performing for bigger and bigger crowds, and his aspirations had multiplied. Now he was back on familiar turf, playing his first full show at the First Avenue Club in more than a year. At the last minute, he decided to call in a mobile recording truck and have his set taped professionally. "The place was just absolutely packed to the rafters," recalled Prince tour manager Alan Leeds. Steve McClellan, who ran First Avenue, was afraid the fire marshals were going to come and close us down. The concert marked the first appearance of the Revolution's new guitarist, a teenage Wendy Melvoin. It was also the public debut of the song that would define the next chapter of Prince's career, and in some ways the rest of his life. Unbelievably, the recording of that very first performance of Purple Rain, with some edits and a touch of added strings, would be the actual version used on the record and in the movie. Tapes of the First Avenue show also provided the basic tracks for I Would Die For You and Baby I'm a Star. Almost exactly a year later, with the album already a sensation, the movie would premiere and Prince's global takeover would be complete. "Listening to Purple Rain now, it's kind of like a Beatles album," says keyboardist Matt Fink. "Every song is just so brilliant in its own way, also unique and different. Prince's earlier work led up to that whole style, but it was more technically advanced than where he was before. it reached a new peak. For countless listeners, Prince was Purple Rain. The album sold more than 13 million copies, more than three times the total for 1999, his next biggest seller. The week that the Purple Rain movie opened, in July 1984, Prince became the first artist to have the number one album, single, and film in the country simultaneously. This unprecedented triumph was a result of his singular vision, relentless focus, and boundless ambition, the culmination of a strategy that even those closest to him couldn't fully see. "I knew what it was going to be," Prince said. "Then it was just like labor, like giving birth. In 84, it was so much work." The success of Little Red Corvette the previous year had opened the door for the pop breakthrough Prince had longed for. Guitarist Des Dickerson described the audiences on the 1999 tour as a tidal wave of white, getting whiter and whiter each night. Prince began reconfiguring his sound, his style, and his band in ways that would connect with the broadest possible target. He knew that he could extend his reach into the rock and roll world by presenting himself as a badass guitar player fronting a real band, rather than as a loner studio wizard. Crucially, he also made one key change in the Revolution lineup, replacing Dickerson with Melvoin, a childhood friend of keyboardist Lisa Coleman, who had been hanging around the tour and made a few vocal contributions to 1999. A band that had previously had a front line of three black men was now mixed in terms of race and gender. It was a visual manifestation of the sonic goal Prince had presented to his musicians, a cross between Fleetwood Mac and Sly and the Family Stone. "Maybe because we came together from different corners," says Coleman, "and were able to share our souls so intensely toward one center, other people felt it." From the start, the music on Purple Rain had been conceived in parallel with the movie idea. No one around Prince understood his vision, and his managers weren't sure they could get a film made. Eventually, they found a director, Albert Magnoli, who'd never made a feature, and work began. When Prince first met with Magnoli, he presented him with dozens of new songs to consider. As the story came into focus, though, Prince knew that he needed the music to relate directly to the narrative, almost an extra long-form music video. "It was a work of genius on his part to make all those songs fit into the story," says Fink. The inspiration for Purple Rain itself was in some ways less biographical than professional. Out on the road, as he scribbled away in his purple notebook, Prince often found himself pulling into the nation's hockey rinks on the heels of his fellow Midwesterner, Bob Seger. Perpetually competitive, he wanted to understand the key to Seger's appeal. Fink offered that it was the big, lighter-raising power ballads, "We've Got Tonight," "Turn the Page," that Seger's fans loved. Prince set himself the goal of writing such an anthem, which he first sketched out to the band in December 1982. His crossover dreams were so big, in fact, that he initially sent the track to Stevie Nicks. He played keyboards on her hit Stand Back and asked if she would write the song's lyrics. She replied, "I wish I could, but it's too much for me." Later, Prince worried that he'd hit the arena rock bullseye too closely and that the song sounded similar to Journey's hit Faithfully, so he called keyboardist Jonathan Cain and played the song over the phone to make sure the group wouldn't challenge his copyright. On the heels of the First Avenue show, the first batch of songs he presented to the Revolution were, they felt, too pop, not funky enough, so Prince brought in the raging Darling Nikki, with its infamous line about the title character masturbating with a magazine, that would later set in motion Tipper Gore's creation of the Parents Music Resource Center. Songs were added and dropped from the track list. Wednesday, with singer Jill Jones, and Electric Intercourse both made it, then were cut. The most elaborate composition of the bunch, Computer Blue, expanded past 14 minutes, including a spoken word section vaguely reminiscent of Jim Morrison's recitation in The Doors' The End, but it was subsequently trimmed down. Prince had given the Sunny Take Me With You to Apollonia 6, his female trio Vanity 6, which had just been configured around his Purple Rain co-star. But then he grabbed it back to be a duet between him and Apollonia. Engineer Susan Rogers recalled the actress warming up her inexperienced voice with When I'm 64. Though Prince had performed Let's Go Crazy at First Avenue, he re-recorded it with the band live in their rehearsal space, then overdubbed the cataclysmic closing guitar solo. Filming in Minneapolis concluded in late December 1983, but the music continued developing through the editing phase. Magnoli told Prince that he wanted to make a montage sequence, intercutting a recap of the different storylines with footage of Prince driving his motorcycle around town. He asked for a song to accompany the scene. The next morning, Prince handed over two new recordings, one of which was When Doves Cry. With a grinding guitar line, cryptic yet emotionally charged lyrics, and no bass part, it sounded like nothing else. There was something hypnotic and addictive about the song. The first time I heard it, I knew it was going to be big, just from the piano hook, says Leeds. It wasn't a typical R&B lyric, but that hook was licensed to get crazy with everything else. The final assembly of the album was simply perfect, with not a second wasted. It displayed all the elements of Prince's brilliance. Pop, funk, rock, dance, sex, humor, spirituality, in flawless balance. Notably, it was also the most collaborative project he would ever release, with The Revolution contributing key parts to many of the album's tracks. In May, more than 2 months after it was recorded, When Doves Cry was released as the first single from Purple Rain. By the time it hit number one, the album was released and it quickly topped the charts, where it remained for the next 6 months. Suddenly, the buzz around this movie, for which Prince would not do a single interview or promotional appearance, was at fever pitch. When Purple Rain hit theaters in July, it earned back its full budget in its opening weekend. The dramatic segments sometimes felt amateurish and at times misogynist, but there was something emotionally true at the core of the film. Though it wasn't precisely Prince's own story, it captured some of the conflicts and torment in his life, and gloriously represented the edgy cultural mix of the Minneapolis scene. The project that seemed like Prince's pipe dream even won an Academy Award for Best Original Song Score, and it pulled off something of a miracle. The movie managed to make him the biggest star in the music world, while only increasing the mystery around his personal life. The success of Purple Rain transformed Prince's career forever. He once described it as, "My albatross. It'll be hanging around my neck as long as I'm making music." Another time, he said it was, "in some ways more detrimental than good. It pigeonholed me." But the songs from this album remained at the center of his repertoire for the rest of his life. It's only fitting that Purple Rain was the last song he ever performed on stage. Here are a few more comments by prominent artists on Prince and his legacy. First one's by Stevie Wonder. "Prince's music was so picturesque that even I could see it. I could see his boss, Mr. McGee, who thought Prince was never going to be shit. I could see Old Man Johnson's farm. I could feel that Purple Rain, too. Prince's songs were that vivid, the images that strong. I think I related to the way Prince saw things because we both grew up in the Midwest, where we met all kinds of people and had a great spectrum from which to learn. We grew up hearing blues, rock and roll, jazz, and gospel, and found the value in it all. When Prince and I spoke last, we talked about how we needed to fix this world. All this bullcrap about getting our country back and make America great again, it's always been great. We just have to stop filling people's minds with lies and prejudice and open up the possibilities. Prince was so inspired and so inspiring. He was kind, he was disciplined, and he knew where he wanted to go. He was able to make big transitions. If Michael was the king of pop, Prince should be the emperor. Prince fought for his artistic freedom. By following his own path, Prince took music to a whole other place, as the Beatles did. He wanted to change the way things were, like Marvin Gaye. To do that, you have to be very sure of yourself. The spirit that drove him gave us an incredible reservoir of music. He loved funk, so he really needed to know how to make things funky. He loved jazz, so he needed to break down what made things truly swing. If Prince wanted to talk about love and sex, he got really into that, deep. And he made us see and feel it all with him. In fact, I'm trying to figure out which child of mine was born because of listening to Prince. The next comments are from Billy Gibbons, he of ZZ Top fame. I was at the 2004 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony when Prince brought down the house with While My Guitar Gently Weeps. He cracked the code. Prince had long presented himself as a consummate entertainer. That night, everyone realized this flashy showman was steeped in genuine musicianship. A few years later, I got to meet Prince after another Rock Hall event. His big shot bodyguard invited me to Prince's corner table, and we talked about music and guitar into the wee hours. He was so genuine and sincere, but he was also comfortable in being Prince. In fact, he enjoyed inviting me over. "Hey, I'm Prince, and I can get you." The next comments are from Gwen Stefani. I still can't believe I got to cross paths with Prince. He had such a huge impact on me. When I met Tony Kanal, he was literally obsessed with Prince. I know all those records, and I'm a huge fan. I can't believe he's gone. It hurts me. The first time we met, I was on stage with No Doubt in Minneapolis in the 90s, and I looked out and I could see his silhouette. I was like, how is this happening? Later, I sent him the demo to this song, Waiting Room. He called me and said, "Hey, I had to rewrite the song, but I think you're going to really like it." He had us fly to Minneapolis, and he played on the version of the song that you hear on No Doubt's Rock Steady. I also sang a song with him called So Far, So Pleased. Those sessions, I was petrified. He put me in the booth and he sat there at the board and he sang me every single note through the microphone. He's like, "Okay, here's your next note." I was in there for like 8 hours. He was unbelievable. He was such a genius that you can't believe he existed, like Joni Mitchell. These are remarks by Sheila E. A friend of mine worked at a record store in Oakland and they got this huge poster of Prince's first album. I was like, "Oh my God, he's beautiful." I took it home and put it right next to my waterbed, and I would stand next to it and say, "I'm going to meet you someday." Then I saw him play. He wore a trench coat, a G-string, leg warmers, and boots. I met him afterward, and I said, "Are you sure you want to wear that outside?" I'd never seen a man dressed like that. He was my favorite guitar player in the world. That's why I fell in love with him. One time during the middle of the Sign of the Times tour, we were in the middle of Purple Rain. My eyes were closed and I was in a place of bliss and heaven, on the verge of crying. I opened my eyes and he asked me to marry him. I just kind of said, "Yes," and we kept playing. I don't regret not marrying him. If it was supposed to happen, it would have. We became friends first, then fell in love, then we fell apart. Then we became like brother and sister. He was my buddy. I called him honey or baby. Some people say his best songs were in the 80s, but if he had stayed that way, it would have sounded dated. He was searching. Music was his life, and he lived and died for it. That's his legacy. The final set of comments are from Jimmy Jam, who was a producer and also a former bandmate of Prince. We both went to Bryant Junior High in Minneapolis. At first, I didn't know him because of music. I knew him because he could play basketball. He was like Steph Curry, but shorter. He just had such great hand-eye coordination, which I think went a long way in his musicianship, too. He had a huge afro, and if you had an afro in those days, it was definitely a premium. He would come up to the court with the ball, and the girls would just be screaming, "Ah, Prince!" Our school offered a keyboard class. In the very first class, Prince was sitting next to me. The teacher handed out sheet music, and it was real simple songs. Mary Had a Little Lamb, London Bridge. As soon as the teacher left the room, we started jamming. His keyboard runs were amazing. He was doing things I couldn't dream of, and I thought of myself as a pretty good keyboard player. There's something that draws you to certain people, and I felt that way about Prince. I knew this kid was unique. He always had a certain star quality and a quiet charisma. He wasn't the life of the party, but you could tell he was very observant. There was a school musical, and they needed a band. Prince and I volunteered. At our first rehearsal, he plugged his guitar into the amp and did the solo to this song, "Make Me Smile," by Chicago, ripping it note for note, a 2 or 3 minute solo. He was 13 or 14. It was crazy. At the time, I fancied myself a drummer. At one point, I went to the bathroom, and someone got on the drums. I thought it was the teacher. But I came back, and it's Prince. He's wearing the drums out to the point where I didn't want to sit behind the drums anymore. That's what I remember. Thus concludes Rolling Stone's special collector edition on Prince, the ultimate guide to his music and legend. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother? Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcast. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.